Hello.
Hello.
This is Gabriella.
And this is Claudette.
And you're listening to
Erratic Dialogue.
Erratic Dialogues.
Okay, next segment, television. And I promise to keep these next two segments shorter. I just get so enthusiastic about things.
Yeah.
And also because, like, we literally have not really done this since March.
Yeah, I mean, it's just crazy. Like, I can't believe life has just gotten so much in the way.
So television, what about television have you been watching?
Well, I binge-watched The Crown, which I did not expect ever because I'm, like, not a royalist in any kind of capacity. Like,
well, to me, in my mind, it's, like, basically propaganda.
It is, like, royalist propaganda to, like, the nth degree. But, like, it is just so well made and the performances are so good. And, like, it's really just a family drama. And that's what makes it very compelling. And in the backdrop, you have Winston Churchill, which I quite like. Like, anything with Winston Churchill, not anything. So my deep, dark secret is that listening to Churchill's speeches makes me cry.
Oh, really?
Like, I burst into tears. Like, you know, with the cold, you know, we'll fight them on the beaches, blah, blah, blah. Like, I just, streams of tears. It's just, I don't know, I've had this reaction for a really long time. I don't know what it is.
Yeah.
But I just, you know, so I really liked it for that reason, too. Yeah, I find it really interesting. It's kind of, thinking about relationships and gender politics and the figure of the Queen and what she represents and kind of using that to meditate upon, like, what's happening in England now. Mm. I think it's very interesting because I thought it would just be like, you know, here are the royalists and Elizabeth, blah, 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 blah. But really it's about, like, the broader political circumstances and how the monarchy has to change. Or it just needs to be made completely irrelevant, in my opinion. But, I mean, they are completely irrelevant. Just, you know. Anyway, I have a lot of opinions about, but I really enjoyed watching it. It's beautifully done.
I think my resistance to The Crown is because I know Philip is the worst, and I've heard that he's the worst, but I love Matt Smith. Mm. And I'm like, I don't want...
He's really good in the role. He's so good. I've heard. Yeah. The whole point of The Crown is that she shouldn't be married to this man. And yet there's nothing she can do about it. She's trapped. And a crisis that she keeps having is that she's, there are all these things that she wants to do and be able to, and do for her people close to her, but she can't because she's the queen. And if she does it, then, you know, it could presage the fall of the monarchy and everything that her family is and the enormous wealth and blah, blah, blah. Because really in the end, this is all about money and power. So worth watching. Very, very much so. But with a grain of salt.
Okay, maybe I'll watch it in the summer. Well, I'm going to make the conversation turn a much cruder sort of path because my TV show that I want to talk about is called American Vandal and it's on Netflix.
I've heard of this.
And this is a sort of a parody of Serial, but it's based in high school. But the central mystery is... somebody one afternoon broke into the teacher's car park and painted 25 dicks and 25 cars. And the whole TV show is like, who drew the dicks? And one particular dunderhead gets foisted upon and expelled from school, but he claims his innocence. So two members of the sort of news club there decide that they're going to investigate. And on one level, it brilliantly sort of underpins all the tropes of, like, Serial and those, like, true crime sort of documentaries. And it's also deeply funny. Mm. There's some really, really crude versions of, like, replay animations.
Right.
About, like, there's a replay animation about, like, a sex act. that is one of the funniest things I've seen all year. But it's actually, once it gets to the end, I actually found it really moving. And it's actually about kind of ostracism and what it means to be different in high school and sort of the expectations and failures of the failures of promise that high school bring. And I think it's pretty excellent. Any other TV?
Nope. I tried to watch the reboot of Star Trek, but I got like 4 episodes in and it's so badly written. Like, it is just it's out of canon. Mm. And okay, so I'm a Trekkie, I will admit. I mean, maybe I'm not a Trekkie. I mean, I don't have any costumes or anything like that. I just really love Next Generation. And I was super excited about this.
This is the one with Patrick Stewart, right?
Yeah, that's Next Gen. And this one has Lucius Malfoy.
Jason Isaacs.
And some other, like, really good actors. But I just couldn't get on it. It was like, Star Trek is kind of more like sitcom in space without the jokes, but everything is kind of tangentially connected, but it's like different scenarios and figuring them out, like using, you know, diplomacy or science to...
And you told me that it's also about very philosophical.
Yeah, it's very philosophical, like what it means to be human.
Yeah.
Like I spend, you know, usually if I'm going to watch TV, I'm going to watch an episode of Next Gen, because like it is...
I love this.
Yeah, it's, I love it. It's like, it's my, you know, comfort TV.
I've got TV like that.
So I was very excited about this reboot, but they got the Klingons all wrong.
I did hear about that.
It's atrocious. It's truly bad. And just the script is really like forced. There's this weird romantic plot. Like romance is like a little bit of space in the Star Trek universe, but it is not a plot driving factor. Science is a plot driving, and diplomacy are plot driving factors. But it was just like very like... Oh, it was like overwrought and like technicolor and just not enough beeping noises in space. It was just, I don't know, too over the top. There was nothing, I mean, look, there was nothing, you know, subtle about people in alien costumes, but this just was, I don't know, I did not care for it at all.
It's disappointing to hear.
It is very disappointing.
But I guess, I think all the Star Trek Next Gen is on Netflix now.
It
so
is.
You can watch
it. Yeah. Oh,
so,
I do watch it.
So I've got two more television things. They're all centered about married women. First one is Big Little Lies by the Australian author Jacqueline Moriarty, directed by Jean-Marc Vallée. And it was set among like upper class women in the northern suburbs, and the TV show has set it in Monterey, which is in California. But I think it's a really interesting, incisive look at women and their relationships, and not to spoil anything, but domestic abuse. Domestic abuse is at the center of it, and I think it was one of the most powerful things that I saw. An absolutely amazing performance by Nicole Kidman. I mean, everybody was pretty remarkable in it, but I think she definitely deserved that Emmy that she won for the show. You watched The Young Pope.
I did watch The Young Pope. Yeah. I binge watched in like a week.
And I actually haven't watched it, and this is directed and created by the director who the very thing we ever reviewed on this podcast, Youth.
Yeah.
This is Paolo Sorrentino.
Paolo Sorrentino. Yeah. It's really fun. It is just like completely crazy town in the best way possible. So it's basically, the premise is, what if Jude Law is an asshole and the Pope? So, and the consequences of electing a very old school Catholic to the position of Pope.
He's American.
But it's very magical, and it's very hopeful. And basically the narrative arc is about the young Pope's kind of realization of the kind of Christian that he wants to be. And it's just very, it's beautiful, and the cinematography is magnificent. And it's just like this weird pastiche and mix up of different kind of genres and different things. Like there's this one sequence where he's getting dressed up in his kind of papal outfit with the big hat and all that, and Sexy and I Know It is playing. Like it's just like, and then like there's that, and then suddenly like you cut to a scene where there's like, you know, cardinals in the red hats, and it's just like everything's flowing and beautiful and like a completely different style. But it's very interesting, and it's weird, and it's very camp. And you're not sure how camp it's actually intending to be.
I think it's pretty much full-blown intention.
But I really liked it. What I like about it is that I don't think they're going to be doing a second season. Mm-hmm. I think they're just keeping it as it is. And there are a lot of questions that you don't really have answers to, but that's not in like a plot hole kind of way, but it just, it doesn't feel like it needs to explain all these kinds of mysteries. It doesn't have to tie loose ends up.
Which I do think like looseness... is not something that you normally see on a television show.
Yeah, and it deals with, you know, corruption of the church and sexual abuse. It deals with the mysteries of God and miracles in a really interesting way. It's kind of like if it like has these miracles and yet it also wants you to be cynical about the miracles at the same time, which is really cool, I think. Yeah, I recommend that show.
Okay. Yeah. No, I another thing on my to-watch list. So the last thing I want to talk about in terms of television is The Marvelous Mrs. Maisel.
Yes.
Which is, this is a new series on Amazon Prime, which you can go and watch it. I don't know anybody who has Amazon Prime, but if you do, you can go and watch
it. I had it for like a month and then they charged me $100 and I was like, no thanks.
that's horrible. Okay, well.
Don't be sucked in by the free month. Yeah. Let me tell you that.
Well, anyway, if you can avoid the whole $100 fine, go and watch The Marvelous Mrs. Maisel. This is the new show by Amy Sherman-Palladino, of the creator of Gilmore Girls and Bunheads. So Fast Talking Dames is basically her pitch for basically everything, and The Marvelous Mrs. Maisel is no different. It's kind of this candy-colored 1950s New York where The Marvelous Mrs. Maisel is this 26-year-old Jewish housewife who is kind of the perfect housewife, who takes care of her husband and goes above and beyond to make sure that he is happy. Mm. But of course, we all know that that is clearly never enough for some men. and he says that he wants a divorce one day and he has been sleeping with his secretary. And she's kind of unmoored by this. And of course, as one does when your husband says that he wants to leave you for his secretary named Penny, she becomes a comic stand-up.
Oh, naturally. It's a natural choice one makes in that situation.
Yeah. And it's just a fantastic sort of exploration of comedy in the 1950s. Mm. And her type of stand-up is that type of stand-up which was just emerging, which is the sort of infiltration of the self into stand-up. So it was less about jokes and more about truth telling, which has become kind of the sort of standard sort of comedic setup, where, you know, it's our comedians who are the truth tellers in our society. I think if you think of it as this very sort of nuanced portrait of Joan Rivers' career, it's really interesting. I think it has this amazing performance by Rachel Brosnahan, and it has Tony Shalhoub. And I don't know about you, but I love Tony Shalhoub. So yes, The Marvelous Mrs. Maisel, it's only 8 episodes the first season. I think it's one of, next to Bunheads, I think it's Amy Sherman-Palladino's best product to date.
Oh, I look forward to watching it.
So last segment, very last, I promise. And, you know, of course, when we talk about our favorite things of the year and this being a podcast, we have to talk about the podcasts
themselves.
Yes. So what was some of yours?
Well, you recommended to me, you said to me ages back, you're like, I think of us like, you know, Chat 10 Loose 3. And I'm like, what are you talking about? And I went and found out. So it's Annabelle Crabb and Lee Sales, and they basically get together and talk about books and film and make snappy jokes to each other. Yeah. I think we're nicer to each other than they are to them.
Probably.
I think they're pretty mean to each other. But but no, it's really great. I enjoy just listening to them yabber on about books and the cakes that they make. And it's just very, I don't know, fun.
It is fun. Yeah. Though it's slightly intimidating to just realize just how much they consume considering the careers that they have.
It's unbelievable. I like to think of it like you hear stories about how one of Obama's like secretaries kind of made him like a tape of all the things that, all the cultural things that he should be knowing.
Yeah.
He should know at that particular time, and he would just consume like these bite-sized snippets. That's what I think they're doing, because it is, you know, unless they like do not sleep at night, then it's just not possible that they're making like butts every day. Like, it's just, you know.
I don't know. I have a feeling it's the latter as opposed to the former. I don't think they have, like, the sort of administrative superpower to do that.
Well, my theory is once people have children, like, they don't sleep anyway. So, you know, you just get a lot more stuff done. That's my theory. What about you?
Well, so this is, like, similar to Chat 10's Look 3, but of a very different sort of tone. Mine is Cry Babies, which is a podcast And I discovered it because one day I woke up and I said, you know what? There should be a podcast about things that make people cry. And I was so excited by it. I was like, I'm just going to like, this is, you know, people are going to have an emotional reaction to this. I'm going to like get some really wonderful, humane sound bites. And then I discovered that somebody, of course, has already made it. But I guess the one consolation of that is that the one that exists, the podcast exists, is excellent. It's really good. I could, and that is Cry Babies. It's hosted by Susan Orlean, who's a journalist. She wrote The Orchard Thief, that Charlie Kaufman made the film adaptation of. So, you know, she has a unique sort of claim to fame of Meryl Streep having played her in a film, which I think if there's one accomplishment one would have, that's pretty up there.
She's quite a few individuals, though, like famous.
Yeah, but who is, like, alive?
Yeah, true.
That has played her.
That's, yeah, you make that's a good point.
It's, yeah, I think life would be done, right?
Yeah, yeah.
If that happened. She hosts this with a comic and actress, Sarah Thayer, and it's just so great. I mean, it's weird. It's weird, like, when I say the concept is, like, they have guests who talk about the things that make them cry. But, you know, it's crying can be so many different things. Crying from laughter, crying from, like, you know, romantic nostalgia, crying from grief. I mean, it's just really beautiful.
I should go on and talk about my Churchill thing.
I know. I was like,
that I would love to unpack that.
Yeah, I know. Maybe we should have our own Cry Babies in mind. Because I'm, like, really curious to hear what else makes you cry. But, yeah, I think it's absolutely beautiful. The other podcast that, of course, you know, in 2017 that we have to mention is S-Town.
Yes. I can't believe that was off this year.
Yeah, it was this year.
Wow.
I know that you have reservations about, you know, Serial and This American Life, but I thought this was wonderful.
Oh, yeah. I really enjoyed it. I thought it was such a compelling portrait of
John B. McLemore.
Thank you. But I found it unethical. Like, and it's kind of just, you know, of course they probably made everybody sign off of, you know, their rights in kind of making this, but I don't think, like, I don't know, they basically use a group of quite poor and quite uneducated people and kind of mass for everybody else's mass consumption. And I don't think these people really knew what
had, like, consent about it.
Yeah. Or knew the extent of the reach of something like This American Life.
But how can we say this is any different from, like, any other sort of journalistic product that, you know,
I wouldn't call this journalism so much as entertainment.
No, I think it's journalism. I think, I mean, it's sort of, I know that he discussed it as, like, kind of like a novel. I do think it's journalism.
No, I don't think it's journalism.
Yeah, it's like a journalism, like a Joan Didion or like a...
Yeah, but journalism implies something that's, like, current, political, something that's, like,
you don't relevant. See that?
I think an argument could be made for it. If I could play devil's advocate against myself and say, yeah, it is journalism, but I think it's not made like journalism. I think it's made for us to be entertained and for us to be transfixed. I don't think it's made for us to know more about our culture and to reflect back on ourselves. And to know more about our time as pure journalism does.
Yeah, I know, I disagree. But I feel like this could be like a whole other conversation to
probably
be had.
Yeah.
And it's becoming a very long episode. But I mean, it is beautiful. I mean, I don't know about you, but I cried like at the end.
Yeah, I cried a bit on a bus. But yeah. I really liked it. I don't know, I think it's unethical. Like Dirty John, another podcast this year.
See, I did not care for that podcast at all.
I listened to it in, like, one day. I was just lying on my bed, like I was just cooking and cleaning, and just when I finished all my stuff, I was just lying on the bed listening to Dirty John. It's also, like, in a way, completely unethical, but I really enjoyed it because it was just so, like, gritty and, like, these people were terrible. I love me some terrible people.
Yeah, they were so terrible. I just couldn't. So the podcast, to flesh it out, is about this woman who marries this rather sort of
a psychopath. She marries a psychopath.
Yeah, well, we don't know that, but I mean, like, the warning signs are all there. Yeah. Her children are really against him, but he has his champions, in particular this woman's mother. And I don't know. I just the sort of willful blindness. I don't care for listening to that about that.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I found myself very frustrated with the characters. Mm. But seeing that, I'm describing them as characters because they're not... It's like listening to the you know, like how our parents in the good old days would listen to like long drawn out stories on the radio, like narrative stories on the radio. This is what these kind of podcasts are like. They're not so much as journalism as they're like listening to, you know.
No, I think they're journalism. BBC I
from the 40s horror stories.
No, or I don't. I just
radio plays.
I think that's my problem with like I didn't like Jodie Jung because I didn't feel like I got the detail like I would get in like Serial or I would get in S-Town where like they do. I mean, like, yes, maybe the ethical lines are being crossed about how much consent and how much understanding these human subjects, these subjects receive. But I do think that no other sort of barring a long form journal article in the New York Times or the Guardian would ever like want to assess the sort of the experience of these people on a humane level apart from these podcasts.
I don't think they are particularly humane. I think maybe in Serial, yes, I would say Macklemore's representation is humane. I think everybody else's isn't.
No, how about Macklemore's like sort of like friend he's kind of in love with?
No, I don't think that was particularly humane.
I thought it was. I mean, I thought we were supposed to
look at this man and say like, what a twit. I don't think we're supposed to look kindly upon him at all.
No, I disagree. I think that Brian Reed, the creator, you know, tries very hard to have a nuanced look at everybody who he assesses.
I mean, you
hear about the things that this, the figure completely escapes my mind, his name. But anyway, like, we see him as both a victim and also perpetrator. And, you know, a victim in the sense that it's this sort of, like, intergenerational poverty and the sort of cycle that is inescapable. Like, I do think that there's humane.
I don't think so, because I think it make them the target of a kind of media that's not part of their lives in a way that it's part of ours. Like, say if somebody approached you and said, I want to make an in-depth podcast about you and your family and this tragedy that's happened to you, you would probably say no, because you know what that entails. I mean, not to patronize these people, but the way that they are represented to us, they aren't the kind of people that would listen to long-form podcasts.
Yeah, but if
and realize the kind of the tentacular, you know, reach of this American life and the kind of people who are so far away from them sitting in, you know, and talking about them, I think.
Yeah, but if we said that about every documentary subject, then documentaries wouldn't be made. Most documentaries are created out of like people who are oblivious, and the most palpable documentaries are often the ones of people who have no clue, and because of that very reason they are the most open, the most indiscreet, and that's the most compelling.
Compelling for us as the viewer or the listener, but yeah, is it ethical?
I mean, maybe the ethical line is kind of, I agree, it's kind of shady, but I do think that it's still I think it's humane. Like, if it's treated humanely, it can be a humane project.
I just don't think I think there were humane elements of it, but I think these podcasts is that they seem like journalism, but they're more, a lot of elements is that they're more performance than, like, you know, I don't, yeah, I just, yeah. My sentence just completely trailed off there.
Yeah, I don't know. I think that anytime you get a story, anytime anything, a story is created, it is in some way a subjective thing.
That was the word I was looking for. I don't think it is objective enough to be journalism. And I think we look down upon these people rather than see them as our equal. And I think they're portrayed in a way that they are our inferiors. We are superior to these people.
I think that we look down on these people because of their racism. And if they weren't racist, I don't think I would, like, look down.
I mean, I think, like, these podcasts are created for educated, middle-class, small-L liberal people to listen to the tawdry lives of lower-class, uneducated, you know, people of completely different politics to us.
But how different is it from like a long form article in the Guardian looking at them heartbeat of America, like a Midwest and Trump sort of like.
I guess Trump because County, the Guardian wouldn't do like a 10 article series on one individual and what happens to them and their family. It doesn't tell stories in the same kind of way. The Guardian doesn't write in a novelistic way, while Serial does.
Yes, it is a very subjective series, because I thought it was very humane and very fair to figures apart from John B. McLemore.
Mm.
But you thought that they lacked I think, like, what you're saying is they lack agency.
Yeah, that's what I think.
Yeah.
Because they don't get to tell their story. Editing tells their story.
But you could say that about anything.
I could. Like, I'm sure I could.
A soundbite, like, as you know, journalism uses soundbites. It's not that they don't have the full picture.
Yeah, you're right. I know, but, yeah.
Mm. Well, that was a much more detailed exploration of podcasts.
Well, thank you for being my partner in culture this 2017, and here's to the next one.
Having this avenue to talk about all things, and clearly to a very extended period.
Well, I'm just glad that we disagreed about something for once.
Yeah, I know. Some people have been saying that we agree too much.
Yeah, well, you know what, today I found something.
Miracle of miracles. Thank you for listening to Erratic Dialogues. Read our essays and listen to more episodes by visiting erraticdialogues.com. That's dialogues with a G-U-E-S. Follow us on Facebook and Twitter, and subscribe to us on iTunes.